case as appointed counsel. The court expresses its gratitude for your excellent representation of your client. Next case is United States versus Falcone. Mr. Stevens.
Good morning. Mr. Falcone received an enhancement of sentencing following a jury trial and conviction on a charge of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine. The enhancement was for a leadership role pursuant to Rule 3B, or United States Sentencing Guideline, Rule 3B1.1. That finding by the district court of our contention was a clear error, and the enhancement accordingly should be reversed. The undisputed facts in this case show that a co-defendant, Mr. Valdivinas, was a distant cousin of Mr. Falcone's, but that Mr. Valdivinas had had very little contact with Mr. Falcone for many, many years. They had a chance meeting in Chicago at a restaurant. They exchanged telephone numbers. Thereafter, had a few telephone conversations. Some 3 months later, co-defendant Valdivinas was contacted by drug buyers, including an undercover law enforcement officer. Valdivinas didn't have any drugs. Valdivinas told the buyers, I'll introduce you to somebody who has. And he introduced them to the appellant, Mr. Falcone. Mr. Falcone gave a sample to the buyers. The buyers found it acceptable. Thereafter, the buyers' negotiations were all with co-defendant Valdivinas. They contacted Mr. Valdivinas. They said they wanted to buy drugs. He didn't have any drugs. He went to Mr. Falcone and he said, these people want to buy some drugs. Falcone had drugs. He had a car. They went to Mr. Falcone's house. Valdivinas took the drugs. Mr. Falcone got the drugs out of the house, and Mr. Valdivinas put the drugs in a trapdoor in the car. Mr. Valdivinas drove the car to Hammond, Indiana, where they attempted a drug transaction twice, which fell through, and then on the third time, the deal was consummated. Mr. Valdivinas was the one who had all the contacts with the drug buyers. Mr. Valdivinas, when asked why he drove the car, said, I was taking the drugs to deliver them. And Mr. Falcone rode along as a passenger in the car. The buyers met and spoke with Mr. Valdivinas at the drug transaction. Mr. Valdivinas is the one who attempted to get the buyers to get into the car. Mr. Valdivinas is the one who told them that he couldn't show them the drugs in a public place. They drove to another place. Mr. Valdivinas took the drugs out of the trap door in the car and delivered the drugs, and shortly thereafter, there was an arrest. Now, clearly the evidence shows that Mr. Falcone was involved in a drug transaction. Clearly the evidence shows that Mr. Valdivinas was the initial contact, and that Mr. Falcone was contacted and participated in the drug deal. There's no question but that Mr. Valdivinas and Mr. Falcone conspired to deliver drugs. The question is, was Mr. Valdivinas in a leadership role? This court has recognized that the commentary to 3B1.1 sets out a number of factors, none of which is exclusive, and not all of which are required in considering whether an individual is in a leadership or managerial role. Exercise of decision-making authority. Virtually all of the decision-making authority in this case was at the behest of Mr. Valdivinas, not Mr. Falcone. Nature of participation in the offense. The active participant in this case was Mr. Valdivinas. Recruitment of accomplices. Mr. Falcone did not recruit Mr. Valdivinas. Mr. Valdivinas, his personal record, recruited Mr. Falcone. Claimed right to a larger share of fruits of the crime. There was no evidence as to which of these individuals was going to get any more money than the other. Nature and scope of the illegal activity. As far as the evidence shows, this is the only transaction that these two individuals were ever involved in together, and it was a transaction for a single kilo of cocaine. That leaves us with degree of control and authority exercised over others. The government contended, and the court held, that Mr. Falcone in fact exercised control and authority over Mr. Valdivinos. The evidence simply does not bear that out. What the evidence clearly shows is that Mr. Valdivinos didn't have drugs, Mr. Falcone did have drugs, and the two of them got together and negotiated this deal, with Mr. Valdivinos being the initial contact, the contact all the way through, the final contact, and in fact the most active participant in the entire transaction. For that reason, then, we're asking that the court find that the district court committed clear error and remand this case for resentencing with the instruction that Mr. Falco will not be given a leadership role in the case. The second issue that we raised, two cases were consolidated. Mr. Falco was also charged very late in the game here with an illegal alien offense. The facts are that during the course of the drug case, the prosecutor was ordered by the court to provide a bill of particulars. The prosecutor did not provide a bill of particulars. The defense filed a motion for sanctions. Immediately after the filing of the motion for sanctions, the government filed a complaint charging Mr. Falcone with the immigration offense. We filed a motion to dismiss for vindictive prosecution. In fact, the court proceeded to chew out the prosecutor for not responding to the bill of particulars, and thereafter Mr. Falcone was indicted. Our argument simply is that that is a sufficient basis upon which the court was required to hold an evidentiary hearing. The court, in fact the government in its brief, fails to distinguish between selective prosecution and vindictive prosecution. Selective prosecution is a prosecution based upon impermissible grounds. Vindictive prosecution, however, while the validity of prosecution itself is certainly an issue, the primary issue in vindictive prosecution is whether the prosecutor holds a particular animus without which there would be no prosecution. The fact that a motion for sanctions was filed and that immediately after the government initiated a prosecution on facts which it had known for nearly a year at that point, but it failed to indict, despite the fact that they had obtained a superseding indictment in the interim, we think it's sufficient that the court should have been required to hold an evidentiary hearing and did not. So we're asking the court to remand for an evidentiary hearing on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Lanter.
May it please the court. First, on the issue of the sentencing, it's the government's contention that the district court did not commit clear error in sentencing Mr. Falcone as a leader or organizer pursuant to Section 3B1.1C. There's a number of factors we believe that came out of trial that would lead to that conclusion. First of all, Mr. Valdivinos testified at the trial, and Judge Moody, in finding the sentencing enhancement, specifically found Mr. Valdivinos' testimony to be credible and relied on that in application of the enhancement. Specifically, the government contends that the evidence at trial showed that Mr. Valdivinos was controlled by Mr. Falcone. First of all, on the Friday before the drug transaction actually occurred, another co-defendant, Mr. Alvarado, contacted Mr. Valdivinos for the purpose of purchasing cocaine or providing the cocaine for the transaction. When Mr. Valdivinos got that call, he forwarded the message on to Mr. Falcone. Mr. Falcone was the person who had the supply of drugs, not Mr. Valdivinos. Mr. Valdivinos then arranged a meeting between Mr. Falcone and Mr. Alvarado for, as Mr. Valdivinos testified, for the purpose of so that those two could do drug business together. Instead of engaging in the transaction alone, on the following Monday, what happened was Alvarado called Valdivinos again, who relayed that message to Falcone. Valdivinos, as the evidence showed, was merely the messenger of messages from Alvarado to Falcone. When they tried to do the drug deal on Monday, Falcone provided the car, he provided the secret compartment where the drugs were Stash, and he also told Valdovinos, you're going to accompany me to do the drug deal. Not that he was going to do it alone. He directed Valdovinos to accompany him to do the drug deal. And the government's contention is the purpose of that was so that Mr. Valdovinos could engage in some of the more risky aspects of the drug transaction so that Mr. Falcone, to all outward appearances, would appear just to be a passenger in the car if something went wrong. This is further borne out by the fact that Valdovinos was not calling the shots. He specifically testified that whenever Alvarado would call him, he would then call Falcone. That Valdovinos wasn't in control of any decision-making authority as to when the transaction would occur. He had no control over that. Every time he was contacted to set up a deal, he said, I was supposed to talk to Falcone.
And you pretty much lay out what your evidence is to support the district court's finding. I want to move to the vindictive prosecution because you also in your brief explain why the illegal reentry count was, you explain why it was brought, but you don't really explain why it was brought then. That is, that it was brought only after Falcone filed a motion for sanctions and after you were reprimanded by the court for failing to comply with the order. You know, you knew that Falcone had reentered twice at the time you originally charged him, as well as 3 months before the sanctions motion when you actually charged him with obstruction. And since you haven't provided any explanation as to the timing of when it was brought, doesn't that raise a colorable claim of vindictive prosecution such that there should have been a hearing?
Well, the government would suggest no, and specifically addressing the timing in this case, the trial occurred in about the middle of May. In February, the indictment was superseded against Mr. Falcone to add the obstruction of justice charges, which the government had just found out about through Valdovinos at his plea hearing. After that, the government couldn't add or didn't add the illegal reentry charges at that time because they would have been severed out because of joinder problems. It was a different set of facts, different scenario. What had happened is the week prior to trial, when the sanctions motions were filed, the government, after the sanction motion was filed, the next day filed a complaint against Mr. Falcone on the illegal reentry after deportation charge. That was the same day as the other two co-defendants had pled guilty in the district court. So the government brought the charge at that time, the complaint. This is prior to the drug trial. The government brought the complaint at that time as a fallback position in case it lost the trial the following Monday against Mr. Falcone. In addition, at that time, it was by that time clear that Mr. Falcone was not going to plead guilty. And the Supreme Court has held that it's permissible for the government to bring further charges that it could have brought previously after the defendant makes a decision not to plead guilty as long as that occurs pre-trial.
Well, shouldn't that have been something that the district court had an opportunity to, that evidence as to when it was, because I don't think that was brought out, was it, before the district court?
Well, the district court obviously had access to the...
But I mean, in terms of your setting that out, the explanation you've given us here.
Correct.
Was that set out for the district court?
In the government's response to the district court indicated that, I don't believe it indicated specifically the fallback position, that the charges were brought when Mr. Falcone decided not to plead guilty. The thrust of the government's position in that response was that we were now going to prosecute Mr. Falcone to the fullest extent of the law based on the drug issue and also the obstruction of justice issue. And implicit in that would be that since the complaint was brought a couple days before trial, directly after the deadline for Mr. Falcone to plead guilty pursuant to a plea agreement had passed, that decision now was made to bring those charges when he hadn't pled guilty.
And is that a practice there in the Northern District of Indiana? Because that's not a, I mean, it seems to me you're suggesting that when it's clear somebody isn't going to plead, then you file additional charges on the eve of trial.
No, Your Honor,
No,
Your Honor, that is not the normal practice. To be perfectly honest, it would depend on the individual case. Sometimes in plea negotiations, it is it is brought forward at the outset that we could have charged him with this originally. If we did not charge him with this, if he does not plead guilty to this, then we will supersede the indictment. Another
did
thing,
you indict him on obstruction and on the bribe attempt?
Yes, he was. He was indicted on that in February, and that was, I believe, the day of the week after the government first found out about that. Another reason...
Go ahead.
I was going to say that the other reason...
Well, I don't understand why you couldn't just indict him on a separate case on the illegal reentry. You said you thought there'd be joinder problems, but there was no reason you couldn't indict him for that as a separate standalone indictment or information.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that separate information was filed prior to the trial, and you're
I understand that, but correct. One of the reasons you said you didn't do it earlier when
right.
you were aware of all this was because you thought there'd be a joinder issue, so you didn't want to supersede to include it in a superseding.
Right.
But you could have filed a standalone information or indictment at that time on the illegal reentry.
That's correct, Your Honor. The joinder issue I was addressing why it wasn't done when the government superseded to add the obstruction of justice charge. But you're correct, it could have been done earlier. The government's position is also that since all of this occurred pre-trial, the presumption is that the government did not act in vindictiveness in doing this.
Yeah, and I understand that normally the presumption prevails, but it's just the timing here. I mean, within 3 days of this, and it's a situation where there's a motion for sanctions, and the government was wrong because the government didn't provide the bill of particulars. You know, so I'm not saying that those may not well be valid explanations, but the question, I think, is whether there should have been a hearing on it, given those circumstances. And I recognize it's very rare that hearings are given on vindictive prosecution, but this case might be unique enough that it should have been given.
To further address that, back to the timing of the events again, the government filed their complaint on the illegal reentry charges after the motion for sanctions was filed, but before the sanctions hearing actually occurred. So the transcript in which Judge
Moody... Well, it wasn't filed as a result, at least, of the sanctions.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Did you ever file a bill of particulars?
I believe that a specific bill of particulars was not filed with the court. The government filed under seal a copy of the grand jury transcript. And as the hearing on sanctions brings out, by that Friday before trial, the government had provided to Mr. Stevens, to his satisfaction, everything on the bill of particulars issue. And in that transcript, Judge Moody is clearly concerned that Mr. Stevens has everything that he needs to go to trial. Mr. Stevens indicated that he now knew what the obstruction charges were about.
Why wasn't the bill of particulars responded to in a timely fashion?
There was a number of things going on at that time. The week in which the government was to respond to that, the assistant U.S. attorney on the case was out of the office with his child was very ill, and he had left a phone message for Mr. Stevens about that, explaining the situation. Also exacerbating it was the fact that the U.S. attorney had just moved into new offices, and the phones were messed up, to say the least. So that was the nature of the confusion in that week before the week before trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Steve?
Just a couple of matters in response. Judge Williams said that the government's facts have been set out in their brief, and I do want to respond then to some of the things that that do appear in their brief. The government makes a number of statements about Falcon caused Valdovinos to do various acts. Those, in fact, those statements are unsupported by the records. There is no evidence that Mr. Falcon ever told Mr. Valdovinos to do anything. As alleged in the government's brief, and inspection of the record will show that, other than he told Mr. Valdovinos, we are, come with me to do the drug deal. Mr. Valdovinos testified he introduced the people to Mr. Falcone so that they could do business together. Those two statements are the only statements that show any involvement by Mr. Falcone in any decision-making process. In fact, Valdivina said, I drove the car because I was delivering the drugs. He said, I'm the one who put the drugs in the trap door. He said, I'm the one who took the drugs out of the trap door and delivered them. I'm the one who folded the seat back so the buyers could get into the car. He never made any statement that Mr. Valdivina directed him to do anything. Now, with regard to the motion for sanctions and the issue on vindictive prosecution, the argument that this was a fallback charge in case Mr. Falcone was acquitted at trial simply does not wash. And the reason it doesn't wash is following the motion for sanctions, there was a complaint filed. The case then went to trial. Mr. Falcone was convicted, the very thing that the government said they were trying to avoid. And then after he was convicted, the same prosecutor then brought an indictment pursuant to the complaint. Clearly that indictment was not a fallback position. And our argument is that the court should at least have a chance to rule on whether that bringing the indictment following Mr. Falcone's conviction on the drug offense was, in fact, vindictive.
Yeah, this illegal reentry charge, this has little or no impact on his status here, does it? Because given the fact that he was convicted on the drug charges, if that is upheld, he would still be deportable upon completion of his sentence.
He would be deportable and would not be allowed reentry into the United States legally. If he comes back illegally, of course, the fact that he has a prior conviction for illegal entry is certainly something that would enhance his sentence. In addition, it would increase his criminal history score in the event that he ever came back into the country.
Well, he's got to find a way to avoid all that.
Stay out of the country.
Stay out.
I agree. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.